Hey, good morning, class.
It's about 6:31, and it's October 26th. Let's take a look at the schedule. I'll just kind of flash some of these lights down. Like that one, not that one. All right, so the 26th, we're going to start autonomic nervous system today. We're going to finish up peripheral nervous system. And what else do I know? Practicums are next week for every lab. There's not a lecture exam next week, but that's okay. There's going to be a lecture exam when? 1, 2, 3 weeks away. Right, so that's still 3 weeks away. Exam number 3, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. So you can tell that some of these chapters are shorter than what we've had before, especially if you're working ahead. And don't forget, for that lecture exam, picture ID, please. And put your Scantron in the right Scantron pile, and then I'll get everybody's grades to you really, really fast. And then after that, just a couple more sessions, and it will be Christmas. Class will be over. So keep applying yourselves. Study groups still get together, but don't horse around in the second row right here. Right, so make sure you guys study. Okay, same thing for the lab practicum coming up next week. All right, anybody got a question about the schedule? Schedule's looking okay? I think that's looking okay. All right, I got some materials here finally. The computer was wiped clean, so I didn't have any of my cool diagrams or notes or anything like that, but I do now. I don't have some pictures of some of the previous page, like peripheral motor endings, but maybe I'll get to that next time or the time after that. So I want to start with cranial nerves. And cranial nerves are part of the peripheral nervous system, and I think that's the chapter that we're in right now, peripheral nervous system, which means everything outside of the central nervous system. And central nervous system is made up of what parts? Central nervous system is brain and spinal cord. So all nervous tissue outside the brain and spinal cord are what we call the peripheral nervous system. And there are nerves that leave either the brain or the spinal cord. And if they leave the spinal cord, they are called spinal nerves. And if they leave the brain, they're called, what do we call nerves that leave the brain? We could call them brain nerves, but there's a better term. Okay, cranial nerves, right, because they come out of the cranium. All right, so that's where we are right now. There are 12 pairs of cranial nerves. And I do want you to know the number and the name and a brief function of what some of these things are. And when you get into a certification program, you're going to have to learn a lot more about these nerves, but this is a good place for you to start. And I can see the cranial nerves on this slide because they're in yellow. And if we count them down, we're going to see that there's 12 of them. And fortunately, it's pretty easy to know the number because we just start counting from an anterior part on the brain to a posterior. And so this is how you count. Number one, number two, number three, number four. So it's pretty easy just going from anterior to posterior. You can pretty much just count down. And then what's the last one? Number 12. Right, what's probably not so easy is to know the name of these things. But to get started, let's start with this anterior part. What's the most anterior sense organ on your body? Especially, well, on your head, because that's where we're looking. We're looking at cranial nerves. If you're going to walk through a doorway and there's a glass door there that surprised you, what part of your body would you hit first? Your nose. Yeah, you'd smash your nose, right? So cranial nerve number one right here is the olfactory nerve. Right. And then what sense organ would you smash? It's in your head, would be your eyes. So cranial nerve number two is optic nerve. And so that will help you get started. But a better way to know cranial nerves is to use a mnemonic. And here's a website that you can go to find a mnemonic, but it's probably best to make up your own mnemonic. But in order for you to know what a mnemonic is, I have to give you an example. All right, so here is a sentence, and it has the same number of words as there are cranial nerves. And the first letter of each of the words in this sentence is the first letter of the name of the cranial nerve. And so people use this trick to remember a lot about cranial nerves. And so here is the sentence. On old Olympus's towering top, a fin and German viewed a hop. I do hear some people laughing. That's good. Okay. So Finland and Germany are countries in Europe, and people that live there really like to drink what kind of beverage? Beer. And hops are used, right, to brew beer, just to give you a little bit of a background. And does anybody know anything about Olympus? Olympus, towering top. It's a really tall mountain in Europe, right? So here are a couple, I suppose, guys, doesn't necessarily have to be guys, sitting on a mountain someplace, and they're looking at Mount Olympus, and then they're looking down in the valleys, and they see all the grains that are being grown. And here is a little saying that can help you remember the names of the cranial nerves. Your book has one, maybe you have one, and maybe you should make one up. So the O and on stands for olfactory, right? The O and old stands for optic. O and Olympus stands for oculomotor, right? And then towering top, you got trochlear, trigeminal. A is a motor nerve, that's the abducens, and it goes to a skeletal muscle on the eye. And what does it cause the eye to do? The abducens. It tells you in the word. It abducts the eye. What is abduction? Moving away from midline or toward midline? Okay, adduction is toward midline, abduction is away from midline. All right, so that's a very important muscle nerve for rotating the eyeball right laterally. So abducens. Fin, facial, A, vestibulocochlear, right? G stands for glossopharyngeal. One that I want you to know a lot about is viewed, and viewed stands for vagus. Maybe I'll show you something about the vagus, and as a matter of fact, half of the whole next chapter pretty much talks about the vagus nerve. Okay, and accessory and hypoglossal, right? And something that's interesting to notice that there is one cranial nerve that starts with an H, and that's number 12. It's the very last one. So that might help you put it all together. So the function of cranial nerve number one is smell, and that's called the olfactory sense, or olfaction. That's where we came up with that name. Optic for vision, and oculomotor helps regulate pupil constriction, right? It regulates iris dilation and constriction. It regulates the amount of light that enters the eye. Trochlear is for those extrinsic eye muscles. Trigeminal is sensory to the face. We talked about adductions already. Facial goes to the tongue. Vestibulocochlear is for hearing and balance. And does anybody know why we have an and right here in this mnemonic? And when you look, you'd think it would have what? Okay, an A, but vestibulocochlear doesn't start with an A. And that's because they simplified this particular term. A used to stand for auditory, which is what? The sense of hearing. And so they simplified it into vestibulocochlear because now we know it's a nerve not only important for hearing, which is the cochlear part of this word, but it's also important for balance, right? So hearing and balance together, and the vestibule is the important organ for balance, two kinds of balance that we're going to look at. So vestibulocochlear actually is really nice. It's very descriptive. All right, so some of these functions of these nerves are sensory. And what can you tell me about sensory? What about sensory information or sensory nerve? What's happening there? A sensory nerve, as opposed to another kind of nerve. What's another kind of nerve? Going to be the opposite of sensory. Yeah, you're not really yelling it out loud, but I hear you. I see your lips moving. Okay, it's motor, right? So neurons could either be sensory or motor if they're in the peripheral nervous system. What's another name for sensory? Afferent. Yeah, what's another name for motor? Efferent, right? So some of these cranial nerves are 100% motor, some are 100% sensory. And then some have both functions. We call that mixed. So here is another mnemonic that tells you what the function of a particular cranial nerve is. We would like to know if it's motor or if it's sensory or maybe if it's both. So here is the key, right? So we have a little sentence right here, and what would you guess? How many words are going to be in this sentence? There's 12, right? Because there's 12 cranial nerves. And in this sentence, we either have an S, an M, or a B. S stands for sensory, M stands for motor, and B stands for both. So if you remember this saying, then it will help you remember the function of those particular nerves. So here is the mnemonic. Some say money matters, but my brother says big. This is where I always get confused. Big bucks matter most. Okay, so you can go to medical mnemonics and pick any kind of mnemonic you want or make one up yourself. And so then what would be the function of cranial nerve number 3? Motor, right. And so I won't ask you anymore, but you would be able to figure that out. Okay. All right, so that's pretty much the cranial nerves. This is an exam figure, but remember, you can just count down the cranial nerves from anterior to posterior. There's a little bit of skipping around down over here, but it's not too bad, believe it or not. And these are the functions. Your book might list 20 or 30 different functions for each one of these cranial nerves, but I just want you to know one, and on this list, this is the important one that I want you to know. Right, like the vestibulocochlear, what's its function? Hearing and balance, yes. And the vagus nerve. What does a vagus nerve do? It says right here, it decreases heart rate. It's part of the autonomic nervous system, and it's important because it slows the heart down. There's another part of the autonomic nervous system that speeds the heart up, and it's the mixing of those two kinds of signals that adjusts your heart rate so that it's perfect, right? Just like a gas pedal and a brake pedal in your car, right? But the vagus decreases heart rate, and we'll look at and see some other functions that it has. What's the number for vagus nerve? I want you guys just to yell that out. Okay, like what was I asking what was I asking in lab all the time? What's the medial bone in the leg?
Tibia.
Yeah, tibia. What number is the vagus nerve? Number 10. Yeah, just like the number of fingers that you have on your hand. Okay, and if I say cranial nerve number 10, what's the name of that nerve? Vagus, and what's the function? What's one function? It slows the heart rate down. All right, so become familiar with some of those different functions. All right, so we looked at cranial nerves, and now we're going to look at spinal nerves. All right, so where do spinal nerves originate? Spinal cord, they come out of the spinal cord. Can you picture a vertebral column, the vertebrae, all put together? If you put vertebrae together, you can see the intervertebral foramen, and that's where the spinal nerves come out from the spinal cord. All right, I'll show you some pictures in a little bit. So a spinal nerve are going to be mixed in terms of function. So every spinal nerve is going to be both motor and sensory put together. But remember, signals can only go in one direction down a neuron. So this means that if there's a spinal nerve and the function is mixed, there has to be at least two neurons going in opposite directions, right? That's how they're put together. Anybody remember how a signal goes through a neuron? Remember, there's a receiving end and ascending end of a neuron. Okay, maybe we should say what are the pieces. What are the standard pieces of a neuron? Axon, dendrite, and cell body. Yeah, those are the three pieces. What part is the receiving part? It's the dendrite, and the sending part is the axon. So signals always go from dendrite, cell body, axon. So if that is the case, if it's a mixed nerve, then these neurons have to be pointing in opposite directions if it's going to have a function of both afferent and efferent. Because a neuron doesn't transmit information bidirectionally. All right, so let's take a look at the spinal cord because we want to look at spinal nerves in particular. All right, so here is some vertebral column. Right, and then here's an intervertebral disc. Here is the spinal cord, and you can see the gray matter and white matter. And then I can see a bunch of little nerves coming out of the spinal cord. And I see two locations. There are some close to the vertebral body, and what region is the vertebral body compared to the spinous process? Is the vertebral body anterior or posterior? Anterior or posterior? Think of that skeleton that's upstairs. Or go ahead, palpate the back of your neck. What do you feel? Spinous processes or vertebral bodies? Yeah, spinous processes, right? So these nerves right here are attached to the anterior part of the spinal cord, and there's another name for anterior, and that is? Yeah, ventral. So all of these right here are part of the ventral nerve system. These tiny ones are what we call rootlets, and they join together to form a root. And the function of a root is 100% motor. There's no sensory signals going in this nerve whatsoever. Right? But then I see some rootlets posterior, and what do we call these posterior ones? These are rootlets, but what's another name for posterior? Dorsal. So these are the dorsal rootlets that come together to form the dorsal root. Is that making sense so far? Yeah, okay. And then I see a little bulge right here, and that's a group of nerve cell bodies, and it's in the peripheral nervous system. So that's what we define something to be a what? What do we call a group of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system? That's a ganglion, right? What do we call a group of nerve cell bodies in the central nervous system? That's a nucleus, right? And so it's gray matter in the central nervous system because there are cell bodies and dendrites, and those things aren't myelinated, so they have a bit of a darker color compared to myelinated axons. So here is the dorsal root ganglia. So then the two roots, the dorsal root and ventral root, join together to make the spinal nerve. And what's the function, once again, of this dorsal root? 100% sensory. The function of the ventral root is 100% motor, and when they come together to form a spinal nerve, what's the function of a spinal nerve? It's going to be mixed. It's always going to be mixed, right? And that's pretty important because if you have damage to the dorsal root someplace on your body, you'll lose sensation, right? But what will happen if you have damage to the ventral root? You'll be able to feel everything properly, but what function are you going to lose? Motor function. That's right. So those two functions are separated. And that's why when there's damage even to the spinal nerve, sometimes it's a sensory neuron is damaged, sometimes it's a motor damage. And when people have back problems, they might have an area on their body where they can't sense things, or it might be painful because this nerve is being pinched. And some people might have a motor deficit where they can't control, for instance, dorsiflexion or plantar flexion. Okay, so we got the dorsal root, ventral root coming together after you get through the dorsal root ganglia to make the spinal nerve. And then I see a couple branches coming off. Here is a branch that is making a 90 degree turn from the spinal nerve as it exits the vertebral column. What do we call something that makes a 90 degree bend? A ramus, yeah. So here is a nerve in this ramus, and what side is this, dorsal or ventral? This is going to the back, so this is dorsal. So this is what we call the dorsal ramus. And then here is the ventral ramus. Which one of these two look bigger? Dorsal or ventral? The ventral looks bigger to me. And I think you can see that. And the reason why the ventral is larger is because you don't have very much body posterior to the vertebral column. You just have some muscles back there. So it doesn't need a lot of innervation compared to the rest of the body that is anterior to the vertebral column. So the ventral ramus is carrying a lot more signals, a lot more neurons. All right, now here's kind of a trick question. What's the function of this ventral ramus? Motor, I like that. What else? It is mixed. It is both, right? So mixed nerves go through to the dorsal ramus as well as the ventral ramus. They're not purely sensory or motor like the roots. Only the roots are purely sensory or motor, but any nerve or ramus, both of these rami, are mixed. So that tells us a lot about the central nervous system, these peripheral nerves. There are things on either side of the vertebral column. I kind of see them over here and over here. It kind of reminds me of maybe a string of pearls or something. And these, right here are what we call the sympathetic chain ganglia. Oh, it is labeled nicely as part of your autonomic nervous system, and we're going to look at these in the next chapter in particular. Signals enter from the spinal nerve into the sympathetic chain, and just follow with me when I discuss this in the next chapter. All right, so they come from the spinal nerve into the sympathetic chain, but they kind of look like an auxiliary spinal cord to me on either side of the vertebral column because they go up and down just like the spinal cord does. But what the function of the sympathetic chain is it's involved with sympathetic nerve signals, sympathetic. That's part of the autonomic nervous system. And to give you just a little bit of context, the autonomic nervous system has two main divisions. Sympathetic is one. And what's the other one? Anybody know what the other one is? Sympathetic is one. Parasympathetic is the other. And the relationship between those two is antagonistic, just like the brake pedal, gas pedal in your car, which makes perfect sense. All right, so that is rami, roots. All right, and I didn't name these things. I see it's named on the slide, so I might as well tell you. These are what we call the rami communicantes. This is how sympathetic neurons move from the spinal nerve into the sympathetic chain, and they might even go back in. And in the next chapter, we'll take a look at those. Okay, we got a couple important nerves that I want you to know, and we'll see these in lab as well. And number one that I have here is the phrenic nerve. All right, and the phrenic nerve originates, it's a spinal nerve, so it originates, it comes through the intervertebral foramen at the level of C3, C4, and C5. What does C stand for? Cervical. Right, so it's way up in your neck. Do I see it here? I sort of see it right here. Maybe if I zoom in to just a little bit different region. Okay, how about right here? Okay, that doesn't show everything either. It starts at 4. So I guess we're going to go, right here. All right, so here are spinal nerves leaving the vertebral column, C1, C2, C3, and C4. And I see a network of nerves. That's what we call a nerve plexus. And since it's in the cervical region, we're going to call this the cervical nerve plexus. There are four major ones in your body. Cervical is one, brachial is another, lumbar is one, and sacral. We'll take a quick look at some of those. All right, but it kind of looks like a big mess, right? Just a big network of nerves. And I can see here is the phrenic nerve, and I can see that it gets information from C3, C4. I can't see the one from C5, okay? But the phrenic nerve gets information from various levels, and that kind of describes the beauty of a nerve plexus. The phrenic nerve goes down to the diaphragm. And what's the function of the diaphragm? Inspiration, right? It's the most important muscle for inspiration. So is that an important muscle for you to have? Absolutely. You can't breathe. You can't inhale or very, very weakly without a diaphragm, right? So if there's damage to the phrenic nerve, then you just die of asphyxiation. For instance, if you fall off of a horse and break your vertebral column, okay, at a very high level, then signals can't get to the phrenic nerve. And then, of course, you're going to die really quickly unless somebody knows what. What happens when you can't breathe? How can somebody save you? Yeah, CPR, right? You can breathe for somebody that can't breathe on their own. And that's what happened to Christopher Reeve. Remember that actor? I don't know. It was maybe before your time. I'm not really sure. Right? He was horseback riding, fell off, hurt his neck, couldn't breathe, but he was riding with people that knew CPR, saved him until he could be put on a respirator. And he lived a pretty long time. Okay, so the beauty of this nerve plexus is that if you damage it really high, there are no signals moving through the nerve plexus. But if you damage it at a lower level, right, then there are nerves that can send signals to a vital organ someplace by taking an alternate route to get there. Right, so nerve plexus allows for nerve signals to take alternate routes to get to their destination. And you probably have a number of different ways that you can get to work or to school, depending on traffic patterns, time of day, maybe SIG alerts or stuff like that. You'll listen to the radio and you'll just pick a different route around some traffic jam. So the same thing with a nerve plexus, right? It allows for alternate routes, and it just means that this nerve plexus can sustain a lot of damage without losing its function. That's really the beauty of a nerve plexus. And when we look at blood vessels, the same kind of concept will operate there as well. So phrenic nerve is for breathing, or you could say inspiration. That's fine with me. And what are the roots? C4, C3, and C5. I think that's really nice for you to know. And there's a little saying about the origin of the phrenic nerve, which will help you remember the roots of it. And the little saying goes, C3, C4, and C5 keeps you alive. That's the little saying. Because these things innervate the phrenic nerve. And what's the nerve plexus that the phrenic nerve comes from? None of us can go home until you tell me. That was fast. Good. Cervical plexus. Okay. So let me put that away and go to this big slide here. All right. So now I can see the cervical plexus in the neck. There is another one in the shoulder, and it even moves closer to midline. This is the brachial plexus. That's number 2. And then I see one in the lumbar region. That's the lumbar plexus, and then I see one down over here in the sacrum. And this is the sacral plexus. So those are the 4. And next week in lab, we'll take a look at some of these. These are not in the practicum for next time, but you'll see them in models in lab next week. All right, so phrenic nerve from the cervical region. Sciatic, maybe you've heard of sciatic before. And it's a big complicated nerve. It gets nerve impulses from a lot of different origins in the vertebral column. So let's take a look at, the lumbar. It's pretty good. Ah, this is even better. Okay, so the origins of the sciatic nerve. Look at this big sciatic nerve right here. And it gets nerve impulses from 4 and 5, right? S1 and S2. So if there is damage to S1 and 2, can the sciatic nerve still take nerve impulses to vital organs if there's damage to S1 and S2? And the answer is yes, because nerve impulses can leave the spinal cord at the level of L4 and L5 and compensate for those missing signals that should be coming from S1 and S2 into the sciatic nerve. All right, so just know L4, 5, S1, S2 for the sciatic nerve. These are the 4 plexes that we looked at. And then I want you to know what a dermatome is. A dermatome is the surface on somebody's body, right, mapped out by what nerve from the spinal cord goes to that particular region. It is both for motor and for sensory. And here is a dermatome. I just see a silhouette of a person, and it's blocked out with different areas. Here is one in the neck. This is C4. So all the motor and sensory nerves enter the spinal cord at what level? From this region right here would be C4, cervical number 4. Right? And then here's another one. Let's go down to the leg. If somebody's having pain in this region of the leg or maybe missing sensation, I'm sorry, that's not leg. What is this? That's a thigh. Yeah. In this part of their thigh, then we know there's damage of that nerve that comes from L3. Right? And then this region right here is L4, and it kind of wraps around in strange ways around a particular limb. Look, there are nice transverse sections in the thoracic region, but the appendages, it's pretty strange. So if we were to stimulate the afferent nerve, right, going into L3, what would the experience of this particular individual be? If we stimulated the afferent nerve, what would be the experience of this individual? What's afferent nerve? Sensory, right? So if we stimulate that sensory nerve, Is something going to move, or is this person going to feel something? Going to feel something, and in what part of their body? Would it be leg? Okay, thigh, just in this little band right here, and I see it goes a little bit medial in the knee and a little bit into the leg, but it would be clearly right in this region right here. And if it's above, that'd be L2, and if it's a stripe down over here, that would be L4. And look, L4 even goes all the way down and includes the large toe, the big toe. Okay, and the other toes are innervated from L5. So this is what we call a dermatome. It's pretty handy for trying to figure out where damage might be to a particular nerve or which particular nerve. And then here are the dermatomes in the posterior part of this person. And you can see that if somebody has pain in this region right here, lower back, where, okay, are those nerves going to go? Or where are they coming from? The sacral region, right? The sacral region. So there could be an impingement, right? Or there could be some kind of blockage of the posterior sacral foramina. And so that gives you an idea of perhaps where the damage could be. So that's a dermatome. And we're done with peripheral nervous system. Okay, you know, in that site, medicalmnemonics.com, you can filter what kind of mnemonic you want. It can be PG rated, right? Adult rated, triple X rated, whatever, okay? And that might help you remember a particular mnemonic, but don't give me any triple X rated mnemonics in lecture or the lecture exam, okay? Okay. Any questions on peripheral nervous system? You're pretty good? All right, let's put that away and move into autonomic nervous system. Here's autonomic nervous system. And do I have some slides, autonomic nervous system? I don't think I copied them over yet. Okay. This is nice. Let me look here, look at a previous slide. All right, so this is kind of like the diagram that I showed you at the very beginning of the nervous system chapters. It's just an outline of the various parts of the nervous system, both central and peripheral nervous system. And what we're going to look at now, peripheral nervous system, because we just got done with that, and in particular, the efferent, not the afferent division of peripheral, but the efferent division of the peripheral nervous system, and how many regions or how many different ways can we break the motor division down into? What are the components of the motor division? Okay, I see two right here, right? There's somatic and autonomic. Well, I'm trying to find the slide. Okay, nice. Okay, so I see two, somatic and autonomic. So somatic has, a meaning that it's toward the surface of your body, right? Maybe for sure your skin and muscles. So the somatic nervous system goes to skeletal muscles. And is that voluntary or involuntary? Somatic nervous system means voluntary, right? And autonomic then means involuntary. So it's going to a bunch of other things, other organs in your body, or could even be muscles that you don't have direct control of. So the effector organ, we say that the effector organ of the somatic nervous system is skeletal muscle. That's what skeletal muscle controls. And the effector organs of the autonomic nervous system are, and I don't know if we talked about this yet, but we should know the effector organs, and there are three main classifications. Some are muscle, cardiac muscle, you don't have smooth muscle, and glands. You don't have direct control of glands either. So as a matter of fact, this slide here shows you that you have control, conscious control, over only one aspect of your body, and what is that? Skeletal muscle. That's right, only skeletal muscle. Everything else is controlled by the autonomic nervous system. Sometimes we say visceral for autonomic nervous system. Visceral means deep inside a body cavity. For instance, like heart or smooth muscle of the reproductive or digestive tracts, urinary tract. All right, and if we look at autonomic nervous system, how many different what are the ways that we can break that down? Two more ways. There's a sympathetic division and a parasympathetic division. And there's a relationship between these that is probably the most important thing in this class to appreciate and understand. And that is the relationship between sympathetic and parasympathetic is that they are antagonistic to each other. All right, so that might sound a little silly because it sounds like one is going to make you go forward and the other is going to make you go backwards. Right? Those are two antagonistic motions. And then you'll never get anywhere if it works just like that. But remember your gas pedal and your brake pedal. You don't use both at the same time, right? If you step off the accelerator, you might be wanting to use the brake pedal to slow down. And when you want to speed up, what do you do with the brake pedal? You let go and then step on the gas pedal. And the same thing with the autonomic nervous system. They're both not activated at the same time. One or the other is activated. The sympathetic nervous system is what we call the fight and flight nervous system. This is the nervous system that becomes activated when you're in a stressful circumstance, especially a life-threatening circumstance. When you need to fight that threat or run away from it, this thing is activated. And what do you think the effect on the heart is when that happens, when you're presented with a life-threatening situation or maybe just a scary situation? It speeds up, right? Okay, so the sympathetic nervous system speeds up, and that means that the parasympathetic nervous system kind of turns off when that happens, right? Now, the parasympathetic nervous system is what we call the rest and digest nervous system. So when you're not in a threatening circumstance, when you're resting, right, that this is the nervous system takes over, and also when you're digesting food, this is the nervous system that takes over. And if the sympathetic division speeds up the heart, what is parasympathetic on the heart? It's going to slow it down. And what nerve takes this parasympathetic outflow to the heart? We talked about that not too long ago. Vagus. And what nerve is that? That is the, it's cranial nerve number 10, right? Cranial number 10 or vagus nerve slows the heart down. We're going to look at some other nerves that carry sympathetic outflow to the heart, right? And as a result of having a nerve that speeds the heart up, a nerve that slows the heart down, your autonomic nervous system has precise control and balance of heart rate, which is important. I think you all would agree that the heart is a very important vital organ in our body, and that's how it's controlled, at least heart rate. All right, so we're going to always refer back to this diagram. The next slide right here shows a little comparison between the somatic and autonomic nervous system in terms of outflow. And remember, what's the effector organ for somatic nervous system? Skeletal muscle. Let's take a look at that first. That's the top row. And when I look at this, there's probably some kind of organization to it. I would say all this stuff over here is in the central nervous system, and then all this stuff over here is in the peripheral nervous system. That's how this slide is nicely organized. And then we got a couple other columns, right? Like what the effector neurotransmitter is from these neurons, and then the effector organ, and then what the function is, right? But I want to just concentrate on this first column. Here is a neuron. It's in the cell body and dendrites are in the central nervous system, and the axon goes all the way to the effector organ. And effector organ for somatic is skeletal muscle. And the neurotransmitter that this somatic motor neuron releases on skeletal muscle so that it contracts is ACH. Does anybody know what ACH stands for? Acetylcholine. I'm almost positive we talked about that a little bit before. Acetylcholine. So somatic motor neuron always releases acetylcholine on a skeletal muscle. And remember, a skeletal muscle can't make up its mind to do anything else. It can't say, no, I'm busy doing something else. What's going the response going to be? It's going to contract, right? So the effect is excitatory. It says stimulatory. That's okay to say it like that. All right, so how many neurons does it take for a somatic nervous system to go from the central nervous system to the effector organ? How many neurons do you see right there? There's just one. Yeah, exactly. There's just one. As opposed to all the neurons in the autonomic nervous system. Let's take a look at that. So let's skip down to the next row. All right, so now we're in the autonomic nervous system. Let's look at the sympathetic division first. So here's the nerve cell body and dendrite in the central nervous system. It leaves, but does this first neuron go all the way to the effector organ? It does not. It stops right here. It releases neurotransmitter, and you can see that neurotransmitter is acetylcholine once again, and that stimulates a second nerve, right? And then that goes to the effector organ, and that second nerve doesn't release acetylcholine, it releases norepinephrine. That's what that NE stands for, norepinephrine. And remember, what are the effector organs once again for the autonomic nervous system? We have smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands, right? And when these things get signals, they always produce a response, right? So a motor neuron produces a response, or an effector organ always produces a response, and the sympathetic and parasympathetic sometimes is excitatory, sometimes it's inhibitory, and we'll work on how that happens in just a little bit. But we're just looking at some straight neuroanatomy. So let's compare the sympathetic outflow with somatic outflow. How many neurons does it take for sympathetic outflow to get to the effector organ too? What about for somatic motor neuron? Just one. Do you see that difference right there? Okay. And I can see that if we just look at sympathetic right here, this is going to be a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites someplace in your body, in the periphery, not in the central nervous system. What do we call a group of these nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the peripheral nervous system? That's what we call a ganglion, right? So here's going to be like a little knot inside your body of nervous tissue, and that's a ganglion if it's in the peripheral nervous system. So this first neuron is what we call the preganglionic neuron. The second one over here is what we call the postganglionic neuron. That's just how we talk about it. And if I were to ask you, what is the neurotransmitter for the preganglionic neuron, you would say acetylcholine. If I ask, what's the neurotransmitter for the postganglionic neuron, you would say norepinephrine, but that is particular to what division of the autonomic nervous system? Only the sympathetic nervous system releases norepinephrine from the postganglionic neuron. So this is a really handy chart to see. What are some other differences? Look at this postganglionic neuron. Do you see any myelin around it? No, there isn't myelin. So this is unmyelinated. So how do nerve impulses move down this axon, fast or slow? Slow. What about the preganglionic neuron? Fast, because it is myelinated. Maybe not as heavily as a somatic motor neuron, but it is still there. So that's another difference. Okay, let's go all the way down to the parasympathetic nervous system. Again, nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the central nervous system. They leave. This is the preganglionic fiber. Preganglionic parasympathetic releases acetylcholine in the ganglia that stimulates the postganglionic nerve fiber that we have right here. And then when that nerve impulse gets to the axon terminus of a parasympathetic nerve fiber, it releases acetylcholine, which is different than norepinephrine, right? So that's one way to think about the effects. They're different because they use different neurotransmitters. Depending on the organ, just like norepinephrine, acetylcholine can be excitatory or inhibitory. All depends on the particular organ and what kind of receptors it has. All right, so nonetheless, somatic outflow requires one neuron, autonomic outflow requires two, right? Here's the preganglionic, postganglionic neuron, and I do want you to know something about these neurotransmitters, because that's hugely important on how we treat patients that need help, by knowing something about these neurotransmitters and also the receptors that these effector organs have that can respond to these neurotransmitters. All right, well, there's just one exception to that rule, where autonomic outflow always requires a pre- and postganglionic neuron, And that is in this third row right here. And what part of the autonomic nervous system does this row belong to? Sympathetic or parasympathetic? Sympathetic, and it involves the adrenal medulla. The adrenal just means on top of a kidney, so it's in your back, really close to your kidney. And medulla, does anybody know what medulla means? We looked at this in terms of bone. It's the deep part, right? What's the superficial part of the adrenal gland called? That's going to be the adrenal cortex, really good. The deep part is the adrenal medulla, and we're only thinking about the adrenal medulla right now. All right, so the preganglionic fiber goes all the way to the adrenal gland, and it enters the adrenal gland, goes to the adrenal medulla, and what's the neurotransmitter of this preganglionic fiber? I see acetylcholine. When acetylcholine is released in the adrenal medulla, that doesn't stimulate another nerve impulse, but it stimulates the cells of the adrenal medulla to release norepinephrine, just like these axon terminus here for the rest of the sympathetic system. Releases norepinephrine and also a little bit of epinephrine. Another name for epinephrine is adrenaline. Maybe you've heard of adrenaline before. And noradrenaline is norepinephrine, just some different terms. In this class and most science classes, we just say epinephrine and norepinephrine. Okay. And what is the neurotransmitter of the postganglionic fiber of the typical sympathetic outflow pathway? It is norepinephrine. Okay. These cells are releasing norepinephrine, and so norepinephrine gets in the blood, and then where does it go? Where does norepinephrine go once it gets into the blood? And epinephrine as well. Once it gets into the blood, where does it go? Everywhere where blood goes, which is pretty much everywhere in the body, right? So this particular system is delivering a sympathetic signal everywhere in your body, right? When the sympathetic nervous system becomes activated. All right, so these cells right here in the adrenal medulla are acting like the postganglionic fiber in a typical sympathetic outflow pathway, but they don't transmit nerve impulses anywhere. So the question I have for you is, and the name of these cells are called chromaffin cells, how would you consider these chromaffin cells? Are they neurons if they don't transmit electrical impulses? Because a neuron has to transmit electrical impulses someplace. Okay. So if they're not neurons, how would you classify epinephrine and norepinephrine? Would you think of them as being neurotransmitters? Okay. Well, we know norepinephrine is a neurotransmitter here in this first case, but this one over here is not coming from something that's purely a neuron, so we don't like to call that a neurotransmitter. Norepinephrine from the adrenal medulla is acting more like a hormone, right? So this compound, the signaling compound, gets into the blood, delivered all over the body, some distant location where it produces a response. That's pretty much the definition of a hormone. It comes from a gland, and it goes into the blood. So in this particular case, norepinephrine is acting like a hormone. In the previous case, norepinephrine from the ends of the postganglionic fiber is acting like a neurotransmitter. So that's pretty confusing. Is norepinephrine a neurotransmitter, or is it a hormone? Is it a neurotransmitter, or is it a hormone, if you had to classify it? Well, yeah, see, it's really confusing. Sometimes it acts like a neurotransmitter, sometimes it acts as a hormone, and so, strictly speaking, we call norepinephrine a neurohormone. It has characteristics of both, okay, neurohormone. And that is an important illustration because it shows the intersection, right, and the relationship between the nervous system and endocrine system. At some parts of your body, like the adrenal medulla, they're the exact same thing. And they control your body, right? Nervous system controls these visceral organs, and endocrine system does. And in this particular case, right, the cells of the adrenal medulla are neuroendocrine cells. That's how we think about it. And in a lot of classes, when we study nervous system, we don't just study nervous system, but we study the endocrine system at the same time. And the title of that chapter would be the neuroendocrine system, right? Because there's a number of places in your body where they join together, there's a junction between them, and it's important. This is the first time that we're going to look at that in this class, right? So here is the interface between the nervous system and the endocrine system, making what a neuroendocrine system. So this signal that goes to the adrenal gland, there's only the preganglionic fiber. There is no postganglionic fiber. The cells of the adrenal medulla are acting like the postganglionic fiber. Okay? But they don't send electrical impulses anywhere. They directly release norepinephrine and epinephrine. Okay, so what do we call skeletal muscle? Okay, skeletal muscle produces a response, a voluntary response. What produces a response? An effector, right? So this is an effector organ. Skeletal muscle is an effector organ of the somatic nervous system. What do we call cardiac muscle? That's an effector organ of the autonomic nervous system. What do we call smooth muscle? An effector organ of the autonomic nervous system, right? And then what do we call glands? Oh, this is probably like a salivary gland or something. Pancreas, maybe. What do we call this gland right here? An effector organ of the autonomic nervous system. Yeah, so don't forget. Effector organ for somatic, skeletal muscle. Effector organs for autonomic nervous system are smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. Right, and those you don't have any direct control of, only skeletal muscle. Smooth muscle can decide, and even cardiac muscle can decide what to do based on how much norepinephrine it sees and how much acetylcholine it sees. Right, so sometimes the heart is speeded up, sometimes it's slowed down, and the heart can look at those two signals and make a decision on what to do. What about skeletal muscle? Can it ever make a decision on what to do? You know what? It can't. When it gets a signal, it has to contract. It has no other thing that it can do. That's why we say it is voluntary, under your conscious control. So if I need a drink of Coke right there, and I tell my arm to reach out and get it using skeletal muscle, guess what that skeletal muscle has to do? It might say, oh, I'm tired, I don't want to do it, but what does it do? It does it, right? Anyway. Because that's the only thing that it can do. It's under voluntary control. So this slide is really nice. It's a comparison of somatic outflow versus autonomic, right? And there's a little bit of difference between sympathetic and parasympathetic outflow. All right, let me take a look at this word slide. What is the effector in the somatic voluntary pathway? Who can tell me the answer to this one right here? What's the effector in the somatic voluntary pathway? Skeletal muscle, right? Because that's voluntary. Let's see what the next one is. Okay. What are the effectors in the autonomic or visceral motor pathway? Cardiac, smooth, glands. Okay. All right, so what do I want you to know about these two different divisions? I don't think I have a slide. Oh, look at that. That looks like an exam figure. Okay. Well, remember, there's two divisions, sympathetic and parasympathetic. I think I'm going to look at this sooner or later, but maybe not right now. Let's go to the word slide. All right, so the two antagonistic divisions are parasympathetic and sympathetic. And the way that we like to think about these in terms of function, I'm going to look and see if I have it written down right here, but parasympathetic is what we call the rest and digest nervous system. It means it is excitatory on the digestive system. But what about the heart when you're resting? Does it speed up or slow down? It slows down. So the parasympathetic nervous system is inhibitory on the heart, but excitatory on the digestive tract. So you can't always tell if the parasympathetic nervous system is excitatory or inhibitory. You have to rely on that little saying that says parasympathetic is rest and digest. That's the best way to think about it. And the same thing for sympathetic. Sometimes the sympathetic nervous system is excitatory, sometimes it is inhibitory. And the way we think about sympathetic nervous system, it is that it is the fight or flight nervous system. So think of that circumstance and you might have an idea of what the effect is on various organs. So if sympathetic is fight or flight, what is the effect on the heart? Speeds it up. Also force of contraction. What about respiratory rate? Increases. And there are tubes that take air in and out of your lungs. They can constrict or they can dilate. All right, so when your lungs are stimulated, to get more air in and out of your lungs, you need vasodilation. Okay, so it causes vasodilation. Also, your iris, we've been talking about this a little bit in lab. Sometimes your iris constricts, lets a little bit of light in, sometimes it dilates, lets a lot of light in. So when you're in a stressful situation, what do you think happens to your iris? Does it constrict, let a little bit of information in, or dilate so it lets a lot of information in? Dilates, that's right, so sympathetic dilates, right, the pupil, enlarges the pupil, and then you know what the parasympathetic nervous system does. It's going to be the opposite. Okay, so the parasympathetic nervous system causes what? Pupil constriction or pupil dilation? Constriction, because sympathetic causes pupil dilation. So I don't want you to know a whole lot about the effects of the autonomic nervous system, okay, but I do want you to know these four things. All right, so parasympathetic for heart rate is, yeah, decreases, I would say inhibits, it's inhibitory. And for digestion, it is excitatory because it's the rest and digest. What about respiration when you're in a rested mode? No, you're relaxed, right? So it inhibits respiration and pupil constriction. All right, but the important thing here is if you know what the parasympathetic effect is, you can pretty much tell what the sympathetic effect is. It's going to be opposite because they are antagonistic to each other. So sympathetic nervous system increases heart rate, decreases digestion, increases respiration, and causes pupil dilation. Okay, and the reason why it's inhibitory on digestion is because we don't have enough blood in our bodies to go everywhere. Your body has to pick where it's going to go. And when you're in the fight or flight mode, guess where all that blood should go? Your heart, your skeletal muscle, lungs, but not necessarily your digestive tract, okay, because that's not so important at that particular instant in time. These other organs are more important, right? That's why it's inhibitory on digestion, and then blood flow goes to those more important vital organs that you need to deal with that stressful situation. Okay, the other thing, let's take a look at this. The cell bodies of the parasympathetic nervous system leave the brain stem through a cranial nerve, or all the way down at the end of the spinal cord, S2, S3, and S4, and nothing in between. Parasympathetic outflow does not occur in the thoracic region, okay, or the lumbar region, or even the cervical region, right? It's only cranial and sacral outflow. So sometimes we call the parasympathetic nervous system the craniosacral nervous system because that's the only way out of the central nervous system. It's craniosacral. And remember, it still takes two neurons, a preganglionic and postganglionic neuron, to get to that effector organ. The preganglionic neurotransmitter is acetylcholine. The postganglionic neurotransmitter is also acetylcholine. Let me look at a question right here. Are the pre and postganglionic fibers, means both of them, of the parasympathetic nervous system cholinergic or adrenergic? I'm glad I read that question because I haven't talked about that yet. It's just a definition. If a nerve releases acetylcholine, we say it is cholinergic. If it releases adrenaline or noradrenaline, we call it adrenergic, right? So norepinephrine is part of the adrenergic system and cholinergic is acetylcholine. So that's how I would answer that. How would you describe the difference between the pre and postganglionic neurons of the parasympathetic nervous system? Haven't looked at that yet. Let's go back and take a look. I guess I got to go back all the way here. This is pretty good. So we want parasympathetic. Which one is longer, the preganglionic or postganglionic on this illustration? The longer one is the preganglionic fiber. And another difference is the preganglionic is myelinated and the post is not. Even though they both release acetylcholine, there's a pretty big difference. As a matter of fact, this ganglion is usually located right on the organ that it is controlling or inside the organ, maybe within the wall of that particular muscle. All right, so this postganglionic neuron is microscopically short. It's really, really tiny. Let's compare that with the sympathetic nervous system. All right, the preganglionic is myelinated, the post is not myelinated. Now, which one is longer, the preganglionic fiber or postganglionic fiber? The postganglionic fiber. Doesn't look like very much on this illustration, but it is true. The postganglionic fiber is hugely long compared to the parasympathetic one. Right? It has to go a long distance. That means that the sympathetic ganglia has to be very close to the vertebral column or spinal cord. And then it stimulates the postganglionic fiber and it's got to go all the way to that effector organ. Okay, one last thing. How many terminuses do you see for this postganglionic fiber of the parasympathetic nervous system? How many nerve endings do you see? I see one. How many nerve endings for the sympathetic neuron? Many, right? And that just also illustrates that the sympathetic nervous system activates your whole body. It goes everywhere, but the parasympathetic nervous system is very discrete. It can go to one organ at a time, but not the sympathetic nervous system. All right, so we're going to finish up next time around here someplace. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. Oh, here it is right here.
Earlier.
Yeah, I noticed you signed the lecture
one. Yeah, I signed that one on accident.
You're in trouble then.
Oh, wait. Okay.
I don't have the sign sheet anymore for that. Maybe it's upstairs. Okay. But yeah, just always sign the sign sheet.
Oh, wait. So do I...